All right. Am I good to go, or do you want? Are we doing?
Do you want me to introduce you again?
No, we're good.
He's still Lewis, right?
Yeah, I am. All right.
Did you describe yourself this morning?
How would I describe myself?
Oh, here we go. Lewis, I'm a middle-aged white lady, and my hair is. Go ahead. Describe yourself.
So I'm about 5'10", you know, kind of normal size. My hair is kind of, what is it, like brownish,
okay.
Kind of dark colored hair, short hair, because I hate long hair. No glasses, but I do, I'm wearing contacts, but I do need them, and wearing a tie, you know, because I'm
looking
official. Red.
Okay.
So.
What color is your shirt?
Gray, and then gray pants.
That's my boy.
Shoes. So, I usually don't dress this nice, so. All right, so I thought I'd speak a little bit just about cybersecurity. It's kind of a passion of mine, with it being my minor. And it's just an important thing because as you tune into the news, you hear about companies left and right getting hacked, and you're probably a little worried yourself about getting hacked. So today I'm going to talk about my background in security, some of the biggest threats facing reading services, and some of the things you can do in the case of an event, and finally some ways to prevent against attacks. This is by no means a comprehensive guide. There's plenty of different ways that you can get hacked, physical, software, but I tried to compile some of the biggest ones that I see people violating. So how I got interested in cybersecurity is July 5th, 2019. I was helping a commercial radio group at the time, and I got a call headed back from a family vacation, and we're off the air and we don't really know why, and I thought it was like a wire ready and sound card issue. And then my hotspot didn't work, the guy that I was talking to was hard of hearing, and so about 30 minutes later we get home and I take a look on my computer and I see that every file has the dreaded encrypted file extension. And I'm like, have you gotten any messages on your computer? Oh yes, we've gotten a message that says you need to pay 2 bitcoins to get your files back. Dreaded ransomware. Yeah, so I'm like, okay, this is a little more than a little sound card issue. So contact the owner, and the big concern then is that this isn't spreading, because it's bad if it's happening in this one location, but if it spreads to everywhere in the company, that's really bad. And so we begin the process of contacting everyone, telling them to disconnect Dropbox, don't open any suspicious emails. And right about that time, I get a call from one of the other market managers, and I'm like, well, that's not a good sign, because you usually don't call me. And sure enough, they've been hacked as well. So we were dealing with a ransomware attack in two locations at the same time. And so about $10,000 later, and in just in labor, there's lots of other costs associated with it. And that's on the low side. It's definitely gone up from there. The ransom was not paid in this case. And I started drinking coffee because it was some very long days with that. So then, because of that event, I decided to get a cybersecurity minor at Iowa State. So Iowa State has two different types of classes. They have blue team, which are defense classes, and then red team classes, which are classes in exploiting vulnerabilities. And then there's also classes in the fundamentals like encryption and operating system, software security, things like that. And then this summer, I'm gonna be working actually right across the street at a company called RSM, and I'm gonna be a cybersecurity testing intern there. So at that job, I will be trying to find vulnerabilities in companies and then try to exploit them in order for them to become safer. So two of the biggest issues that I see facing reading services, and viruses, malware, lead into this. They're all just ways to exploit this, are ransomware and then signal chain hacks. So ransomware is kind of what we opened the speech talking about. It's when the hackers hold your files or your systems at a ransom, and you need to pay it in order to get your files back. And there was a survey in 2021 by Sophos, which is a cybersecurity company, and it was said that 37 of the people that responded to the survey had been hit with ransomware in the past year, and that's pretty high. And of those hit, the cyber criminals succeeded in encrypting the data 54% of the time. So other times they were just indicators of compromise, but they didn't necessarily encrypt the files. But then another thing that's important, and we'll get to this later, is only 65% of those who did pay the ransom got their files back. And the average bill for rectifying this was $1.85 million for each company. Now, these are larger companies than most of these reading services, so it may be lower, but keep in mind, it's a lot of money to recover from this. Then there's also these signal hacks, which is this creepy looking dude with a mask. And this originally kind of became famous in Chicago when there was this someone that hacked TV stations. They set up a transmitter that was stronger than the TV stations at the studio transmitter link. And then they were able to override the signal and broadcast their own explicit and scary programming over like PBS and NBC. So that's how it used to be. But the thing with that is you were limited to attacking from within a relatively close distance. I mean, this guy had to be on a skyscraper closer to the receiver than the studio for the TV station. And I mean, I did this when I was younger. I built like an FM transmitter and I'd, you know, sit out on a road and I'd tune it to like the opposite of their, you know, if I saw a truck coming, I'd think, oh, maybe they're listening to country. So I put like classical music on and then turn it on and override the signal. And, you know, some older people are going along, okay, they might be listening to oldies. So I turn on, play some Kanye for them, you know, wake them up a little bit. So the statute of limitations is passed. There's no one from the FCC here. But now that's changed with internet-connected devices. So I don't know if any of you here have a Barracks device. Yep, some of you do. I know Iris has them. We had them at KCMR. It was in about 2017, there was a big thing where they were all getting exploited because they were all available on this thing called Shogun, which is like a Google search engine for smart devices. So any device that's on the public internet and isn't protected by a firewall is on Shogun and you can exploit it. And so all these people had no password or default passwords on these devices. And so stations were getting hacked left and right because they just very easy to compromise. And you know, when this came out, I mean, I did a little experimenting and yeah, I could have taken over like some stations in Texas and yeah, it's not good. Fortunately, I've kind of checked since then and it seems people are getting passwords on things, so that's good, but still something to keep in mind. We'll get back to that. So now we're gonna talk about what happens if you have an event. And some of the questions you're probably gonna be asking are, who do you call? And you need to be thinking, hey, do I have a backup? And then you also need to consider, should I pay? So my first recommendation is stay calm. And I've got this GIF from The Office here where, you know, Michael's telling everyone, stay calm, yelling, stay calm. And he's not very calm. But you need to focus on what you can control and don't get too many cooks in the kitchen because having 500 people running around sounds like a disaster. You need to get people who actually know what they're doing involved. And sometimes you just need to tell some people to just relax and just wait for other people to fix it. You need to kind of work like a surgeon. You need to work diligently. Don't do dumb things. Don't make it worse. But you also need to work quickly because it can spread and become worse. The next thing you need to do in the case of an event is you need to document everything. Because when you get cybersecurity professionals involved or an IT provider involved, they're going to need to go back and try to investigate how it got into your network and maybe the variant of ransomware or malware is on your system. So having pictures of any abnormalities is a very good idea because then someone else can go back and look at that. So don't delete evidence per se. Number three, I would say, is isolate. So if you have a couple computers that are affected and some aren't, make sure the ones that are affected are unplugged from the network and or power. You don't want it spreading over your network to other computers. You don't want it spreading over Dropbox to remote readers or spreading via email to potential donors, things like that. You need to shut down any kind of systems that could spread and wait for someone else to get involved. And then inform employees that there is an attack and that they need to be on high alert. Then you also need to consider to pay or not to pay, but as I covered earlier, only 65% of people get their data back when they do pay, so I'm not gonna say either way, but you know, you're taking a big gamble there. What does happen sometimes is you'll pay it, they'll give it to you back, but then you haven't fixed the exploit, so they'll just hack you once again and request the same amount of money or more. So keep in mind, you're not dealing with some legitimate US corporation that you have the recourse that we have here. I mean, it's usually a foreign actor that's very shady, they want you to pay in Bitcoin, things like that. And then finally, you need to be calling the experts. Find someone who deals with this on a daily basis, whether it be an IT professional or someone who specializes in cybersecurity. And they're gonna need to wipe the computers, examine, make sure what you have that you don't think is infected truly isn't infected, and then slowly introduce the network back together. And you know, don't go to Staples and ask them to do it. They're not gonna know. Like, get someone who truly knows what they're doing here. And then while they're working on restoring things, you're gonna need to restore from backups. So hopefully you have backups and you need to recover the backups. So try to find where your backup hard drives are and find the cloud services that you have files on. Actually, the cybersecurity event I talked about earlier, they lost a backup hard drive in his garage or something, and so that was a big problem. I don't remember. I think he found it eventually. But and then finally, once you get everything back to normal, you also need to reset all your passwords, because if your computer is compromised, you have a possibility of passwords getting saved by the bad actors, and they can go and use those passwords elsewhere. So make sure you reset any critical passwords or really any passwords you can think of. So now I'm going to talk about a couple ways to prevent against this. This is by no means a comprehensive guide, but just some of the biggest things I see just people violating left and right. So the first one is rules of passwords. Don't reuse passwords. It's a bad idea, because if one site gets compromised, then now that password may be in use for a bunch of other sites, and now the hackers have that password that they can use on other sites. So that's what we call moving laterally. If you have a single password for just a single site, then okay, that site gets compromised, just change my password there and move on. That's the ideal way. Another thing to keep in mind with passwords is it's not good to have words in your password. It's good to have like abbreviations or just kind of random characters, because the way that password attacks generally work is it's called password stuffing. So they'll take words and then attach it with numbers, so, and then put those together. So they use word dictionaries and attach it with numbers. And a lot of times they might even take your reading service's name or like your reading service abbreviation, put it into a program that'll generate all kinds of variants based on maybe, you know, your location or your frequency, things like that. And then some people recommend take a sentence and make it into a password, you know, take the first letter of every word in a sentence and then make that a password. And then you can look into a password manager. I personally use one. You can use something for your team, which would actually be a really good idea. There's like LastPass Teams, which would allow you to share passwords amongst your team. And then if someone leaves, you can revoke their access to LastPass Team. And then you can generate random passwords for every site and just have it in here. And in fact, I think there's even a way that you can obfuscate the passwords so some employees don't even get to see what the password is, it just fills it in for them. If you're a reading service over here that's associated with like a state or a university, you may have something called single sign-on through the university, like Azure Active Directory. If you do, that's awesome, and you should talk to the IT professionals there. Have them try to integrate anything they can into this system. If you don't have this, it's gonna be pretty cumbersome for smaller services, so I would, you know, look into at least LastPass Teams. Then a big thing to turn on is make sure you always have two-factor authentication. I know it's a pain to get the codes, but it's a huge way to stop this, because before two-factor authentication, you just need a password compromise to get into a system. With two-factor authentication on, you need a password and something you have, which is the code. So Microsoft said that 99% of the password stuffing attacks were stopped when people turned on two-factor authentication, so definitely a benefit there. They range from OK, which are email codes, up to the best, which are hardware tokens. The reason emails are OK is it at least requires two passwords to be compromised, because you have to have the password to your email and the password to the site, and it's going to alert you if someone's trying to sign in. If you get a password code that you didn't request, that means someone's guessed your password and it's time to change the password. However, the disadvantage with email is you can hack the email from anywhere, and it's not like it's something that you have to carry on in person. So better is SMS authentication, because it's harder to hack a phone and hack text messages. However, there are two ways you can get someone's SMS messages. One of those is through SIM jacking, but the easier way is just to call up Verizon and, I'm really busy, I'm sorry, I just can't, I need a SIM card for my phone, I'm in a really stressful situation. You do a little social engineering and pretend you're someone you're not, and someone can steal your identity that way. I think hopefully the phone companies are getting better at catching this, but you know, if your security questions are what street you live on, that might be pretty easy information to find out. So the even better one is a phone app. That's what I use, because this way you have to have the physical phone, but it can't be compromised like SMS messages can be. However, phones can get lost, so if you do this method, make sure you print off backup codes. It'll give you like 10 codes in case you lose your phone, so make sure you do that as a backup. And then finally, there are hardware tokens like the YubiKey here, and I think Google might have a token like this. Sometimes they're like a smart card that you have to put in a dock. These are the best because you're theoretically supposed to unplug it when you leave, and then that way you're not leaving your computer unlocked when you walk away and go do something. And you can't exploit them at all because they're not like a phone. I mean, I can maybe get exploited on my phone. So these are the best, but like I personally don't even have one because the phone apps work fine. But these are the most secure. Another thing, and this is how most attacks happen, are through phishing emails. I get all kinds of friends and family will always send me an email and be like, hey, is this legit or not? And you know, sometimes it's pretty obvious, but sometimes they're getting trickier. The things to look for, like in this email, they've removed the A, so it's accounts@mazan.com. But if you're just looking at this at a quick glance, you might not notice that. I mean, I can see my grandma's not noticing that. I can see my mom not noticing that. Maybe I wouldn't notice it if I was in a hurry. Another thing they do is they have a legitimate link here listed, but just because there's a link doesn't mean it has to hyperlink to what's displayed. So even though Amazon is displayed, it's linking to some bit.ly link shortener, which is probably going to a malicious site. The other two things to look for, and one everyone here will appreciate, are grammatical mistakes. You probably will notice they'll make some typos because a lot of the time English isn't their first language. And then they'll always write them really urgent, you know, we need to do something in the next hour or else your life savings are going to be gone. They never, they don't just state the facts. They'll always add like an urgent language to it. Then there's another principle in security called the principle of least privilege. And this is something to keep in mind when you're assigning access to things, whether it be physical access to a studio, whether it be who has access to services like Facebook account, who has access to the podcast creation. And that's just ensure that the minimum amount of people have access to a trusted resource. And that's not necessarily that people can't be trusted, but someone, a volunteer or a staff member, their computer can get hacked, or you know, you give them a password on a post-it note, they're a little forgetful, they lose the post-it note, things like that. So an example of this, let's say our friend Dave moves into a new house. Dave creates two copies of the key and gives one to his friend and keeps one for himself. That's doing it wrong, because if he's not available, his friend can let someone else in. The wrong way to do it would be for Dave to give 20 keys to every one of his neighbors. Even if they're outstanding citizens, that means now if 20 houses get robbed, they now have a key to his house. Or you know, one of these people has maybe a little sketchy friend or something like that. It widens the attack surface. So when you're assigning access to something, make sure it's, you still want to, like, you don't want to inconvenience people, but if someone doesn't really need access, they don't need access. Then you also want to install security patches on your devices. Now, there are two types of updates. There's the big updates, Windows 10 to Windows 11, or Windows 7 to Windows 10. And I understand those ones you can't do overnight and are something that you gotta plan, make sure it works with all your software vendors. But there are also small security updates that will happen a lot more frequently. You know, these are the ones that's like a 20 megabyte update that says it'll take 3 minutes. You wanna be installing these updates because these are the ones that patch the what are known as zero-day vulnerabilities, the ones that can be exploited right away. And then same goes for, you know, you may patch your computers, but have you updated your software on your printer? Have you updated the firmware on your router? Many of these, your smart thermostat, many of these devices have firmware that includes security updates, and a lot of times those don't get updated. And that's actually, there's a famous story in the cybersecurity world. There's some casino in like Las Vegas, I think, that they hired like a red team, like I'll be doing this summer, and the way they found in was through a smart fish tank. They were able to get into the casino's network, so keep that in mind. Yeah, I, like, it's like the thing that controls the pumps, or I don't know. So then that goes into our next thing, close down ports and minimize attack vectors. So with all these smart devices, do they really need to be exposed to the internet, or is it something that you can keep on your local network? Like the barracks boxes, there are a lot of people that open them up to the public internet, but do you really need to? You can probably just have it behind a router at your service and you connect when you're there. If you need to connect remotely, you might want to look into something like a site-to-site VPN or a remote access VPN into your network. And then, yeah. And then finally, a recommendation I give everyone, and this can go for your house, go for your service, anywhere, is to set up a guest network on your Wi-Fi router and run all your smart devices off of that. Your smart garage door openers, your smart door locks, smart thermostats, all those things. So then if those get hacked, they're not on the same network as your computers, your financial records, all those things. You know, big whoop, my security or my garage door opener can connect to my smart thermostat. It's not as bad as, oh, the garage door opener now can access all the financial records. That goes, I guess, you probably don't have a garage door opener at your service, but still, that's my recommendation. And same goes for volunteer and staff phones and personal devices. You're not maintaining the security of those devices, so someone can bring in some Windows 7 laptop and they shouldn't be able to see your automation system, and if they've got a virus on their computer, you don't want them attacking your system. So those are my quick tips, I guess I would say. I'm free to answer any questions about this, and yeah, let me know if you have any questions, and I appreciate your time.
That's why his name's Mike.
There was, I don't know, within the last year or so, a lot of controversy over something that Amazon did called the Amazon Sidewalk.
Yes.
Whereas, if I understood it correctly, if you had a Lady A, Minerva, whatever you want to call her,
it's a new one.
It would share. Allow other people that were close by you to get into your internet. Is that how that worked, and is it still around?
As far as I know, it's still around. I think that was something that like the Amazon devices could like talk to each other on their own network. But that's again that goes into the guest network discussion. That's why it's good to get those kind of devices on a guest network, because the Internet of Things devices aren't quite as secure as a computer. So, but yeah, I would recommend turning that off if it is on your device. I think it was, if I remember right, it was used to like, if your neighbor's Wi-Fi signal, or like if your neighbor's Wi-Fi signal was weak at the doorbell, but it could pick up your Wi-Fi, like it would use that or something like that.
Something like that.
So then you're having to rely on having to trust Amazon to keep it secure, which, you know, probably is fine, but, you know, it's never good to rely on someone else for security. Cool. Yes?
This is Bailey with the Recording Library in West Texas. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate you mentioning the security with barracks boxes.
Yes.
Because unfortunately I can talk about this because we were hit with a ransomware virus in 2019, and I think you wrote this about us, which I'm kind of offended. They got in through our barracks box because of a very old password. Yes, I was like sitting here having anxiety because it brought back so many memories. But yes, it is worth, I know that we have very specific things that we use IT people for and they can remote in and help us, but getting a local IT company on board to come in and look at your setup is very beneficial because, they wanted $50,000 for us to retrieve our files from someone in Pineapple Island, wherever that some spot
is. That's a lovely place to go.
That's really nice. I was like, can we just come there and get our files? We ended up spending almost $12,000 to get our files back, and it took 6 months of them running a Barracuda software to try to retrieve our files, and we never got some of those back. So it is worth to spend the money for the IT ahead of time before you're stuck with $100,000 letter, and it's creepy too. Mm. Yes.
Do you have a backup drive that should rotate out?
Yes, we have a very, we're like Fort Knox now. So,
Lewis, is that another thing that you do?
Yes, backups. I must have skipped over that. So the backups, I can talk about this all day. So there's something called the 3-2-1 principle with backups. You want to have 3 copies of any data, and you want those in 2 locations, and one of those being the cloud. So you've got the copy on your computer, and then you've got a copy on the cloud, so a backup service like Backblaze or Google Drive or Dropbox. There's thousands of them. And then I would also recommend an external hard drive that's not plugged into the system. A backup hard drive plugged into your computer is pretty worthless because it's going to get infected right along with your computer. But have a hard drive that you take home to your house once a month and bring back, because the cloud backups are great, but they do take some time to restore. Just downloading the files will take some time. So an external hard drive is the best way to do it quickly. And it's just always good to have an offsite copy.
If you get hacked, isn't your Dropbox backup gonna get hacked?
Possibly, yeah. So that's why you want the hard drive at your house. It's the cloud backup's good if you have like a natural disaster, like a fire, and then the hard drive at your house that's not connected to the system is good for that kind of application.
Yeah, just to follow up with what you said there, I used to work with a company and every night, every day during the day, a backup was basically created, and every night somebody would take a hard disk home with them, and then the next day they would come back with it, and then a different hard disk. So it was like 2 or 3 of them that were always being cycled through the office, and every third day you would get a fresh backup on your hard drive that you took home, and then somebody would take one home every weekend too. So it's that's a reasonable cost way to make sure you have a good backup somewhere.
Oh yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah, hard drives are pretty inexpensive. It's worth getting a couple and having them as backup. Yeah.
Question. excuse me. Now you had said, of course, not giving lots of people the same key. Mm-hmm. But if we have things that multiple people can make their own logins for, is that better than having one login to the same?
And you're saying you have an owner, let's say with files, you could have one Google Drive account that everyone shares, or you have one person that owns a file and then shares it with a bunch of individual accounts. It would be better to do it that way, because if someone needs to have their access revoked, you can do that. If everyone's sharing an account, you can't do that.
So audio reader papers at gmail.com that everybody has the password for, or Seth has password for, is not a good idea.
Probably not, no.
The same password that's on everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. ARNet71, if anybody wants to try
and hack in. Okay. Great. All right, any other questions?
Yeah.
All right, thanks so much for the time. I know we're working for you, and I'm sure I'll talk to you soon.